Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
Welcome to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stasi Olkowski.
Today is Monday, March 11th, 2024, and we are here to talk about becoming a storyteller, and maybe more than one different storyteller.
Yeah. Well, as we proceed. Who knows?
How are you, Stash?
Oh, I'm fine. Yesterday was quite a day, you know. And I'm sure you must have watched the Oscars last night.
No.
Are you going to say no? You didn't?
No.
No, I'll be darned.
Can't remember the last time I watched the Oscars.
When Ben-Hur won, probably. And you were 3 years old.
Well, I cannot remember ever watching a full program of the Oscars, and maybe never.
I can never remember not watching it.
That's interesting. Your whole family would watch?
No, I mean me, wherever I was.
As an adult?
Ever since the first time I ever saw the Oscars. I don't know when they started broadcasting, but I was probably young and married then. But I don't remember the Oscars when my parents, I know they had the Oscars when my parents were around, but I don't remember it being broadcast then, but I'm sure it was. I'm also sure that we probably didn't watch it as a family, but I always like all the nonsense, you know. I like to see what's going to happen. Somebody's going to do something crazy and stuff like that. I thought it was a pretty good program last night. I thought they did some original things, and the host was good. Jimmy Kimmel was very funny and stuff. And there was no politics involved, except Kimmel was outrageous talking about the former president. He got in about six different good shots during the night, which was good. I liked, you know. There was a lot of nice things on the program, nice songs and stuff like that. And people who won awards spoke nicely about a number of things. There wasn't any kind of crazy, stupid nonsense, you know. It was just an entertaining show.
Well,
music was good.
So you got what you came for.
Yeah, and yesterday I was invited. I was a part of a trivia team for a number of years when I lived in Sharpsburg. And when we first moved over to here, but for the last, I don't know, about 18 months or so, I stopped going to the trivia because it's Monday nights. And even though it's only, you know, a 15-mile drive, 14-mile drive or something, I hate going out and driving at night, you know? So I had stopped being on the team. But earlier, about 3 months ago, we got a call, and they, people from the team, we were good friends of them, a couple of them are good friends of mine, said, we qualified for the championship, and we would like you to be, we can have 8 members on the team, and we'd like you to be one of those 8. And I said, well, I haven't been there I know, but you know, we like you, your expertise in science and math. So, well, anyway, and I thought, and I reminded him, you know, I go to a doctor because of my memory. That doesn't matter. Anyway, so I went yesterday, and there were 11 teams in this championship, and it was held at Bender's Tavern in Sharpsburg.
Wow.
And it was, you know, it was packed, you know, 8 members for each team. And we finished 4th out of 11 teams. We missed being in the medals. There were medals for first, second, and third, and a money prize. And we were fourth by 1 point.
Oh.
And I was, you know, but I was very pleased because I, of course, any member of the team could have said this if I hadn't given my right answers, you know, but there were a number of science questions and a couple of other things that I knew and, you know, contributed. And if I had, we would not have been in fourth place. We would not have been anywhere near fourth place, probably, because I had a number of pretty good science answers that were important. And so that made me feel pretty good. I'm looking forward to telling my doctor the next time I see him how my memory was not perfect, but
what
was
a great
good.
Story. That's yeah. good, Stash. I wish I had been there.
Yeah.
Was it a packed house?
Oh, you could hardly get in the door.
Wow.
You know, I mean, you can imagine, you've been to Bender's, so you can imagine 88 people plus the people waiting on tables, people eating and stuff like that, plus the guys running the show, on, you know, with a TV and a radio, I mean, you know, microphones and all that stuff. That's a kind of a small venue. So there had to be, you know, had to be a minimum of like 95, 96 people in that room in the bar. So,
wow.
Anyway, it was fun. It was good to see the people that were on the team.
Has it always been held at Bender's?
No, this was the first time that the championship was held there.
Oh.
You know, and I think in the past we'd qualified for the championship like 3 years ago, and that was in a big place, someplace in Shepherdstown. And I remember looking around; there weren't that many people there.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? There was probably there were probably 100 people there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a room made for 500.
Yeah.
And I think that over the years, I've heard that the other places don't draw a crowd. You know, who wants to go and watch a bunch of middle-aged to old people answering questions and, you know, and stuff like that? You know, it's not like the television show.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not exciting because there's no television. anyway.
But it was recorded?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
No, you know, it's it's kind of interesting because the two guys that acted, one guy that runs a show and his partner run this, he actually makes money doing this. I don't know how. I think he probably gets paid by maybe he has it. He does it weekly at a number of different restaurants and bars. And he has it. He organizes it, you know, stuff like that. He does all the work. But I think it's through a company of some kind. Because he does this. He's a former teacher and he's retired. And, you know, anyway, It was fun. I did not like the way they did the end of it, but that's just me. I always have an opinion about stuff. You probably have noticed
that. Yes.
You know, they just
had, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, it was different this time because there were seven rounds, and the last round there were. In the first six rounds, if you got a question right, you got a point. And that was it, you know. So in the first six rounds, you could get 60 points. But in the last round, you could get as many as 30 points or you could lose 30 points.
Wow.
So that was a killer for a lot of people, you know. Yeah, so, right.
High stakes.
Yeah, and I don't like it when you change rules. It's like overtime rules When I change overtime rules in games, penalty kicks in soccer and stuff like that and all,
Wow. Okay. Well, let me say thank you to Andy Offit-Urban for opening our show, first of all, with Terry here, his song. And thank him for always opening the show with his song. We really enjoyed that.
Yeah. So, and we've been on the air for 10 minutes, in case you wanted to know.
That's what my clock says. So I agree.
Look at that. We're synced. How about that?
Well, tell us about our speaker for Speak coming up.
Peter Cook, the deaf storyteller, tomorrow, March 12th at 7:30 p.m. at the Community Center in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. And Peter Cook is a deaf storyteller. He will have an interpreter with him, and he is a marvelous storyteller. And the first time I saw him, I could not believe it, because I thought, how can someone who can't hear tell stories? Because he probably has a hard time speaking. That was my initial thought, was people I knew who were deaf often had speech problems and stuff, and were kind of shy. I never knew any deaf person that really wanted to get up and tell a story. And but anyway, he just wowed the audience the first time I saw him, and I've seen him a couple times since, and he's marvelous. So I'm really looking forward to that. And
I am too.
I'm hoping nothing keeps me from going out tomorrow. So
he is an excellent storyteller. Right. I've been really impressed with him.
So www.speakstoryseries.com. Go to our website and you will find the lineup, and you can find you can sign up to get season tickets or just one-time tickets and find out all the details about the entire roster from now until until November. The series goes all the way until November, and
very exciting tellers coming.
It's really going to be great. And in November will be a commission piece, much was done last year with Diane Macklin. The new commission piece will be with someone new. Diane was the original one last year, but the $2,000 prize offered to someone writing an original story that will be premiered. And that person's been selected as of this date, but we haven't had the announcement. I think maybe tomorrow night the announcement will be made of who it is, but I'm not positive of that. So tune in.
I will be there.
Good.
Not sure if I'll be in person, but I will be there.
You'll be there somehow. Maybe somebody will just carry you. Never mind.
I'll come by camel. Yeah.
There you go.
So on our theme today, becoming a storyteller, do you want to start us off?
You know me. I always like ladies first.
Why is that, Stosh? Okay.
What? Oh, well, because I was raised to be polite. Always. And I try to be. Come on now, I'm trying to repair what the audience has heard with your little snickers and side remarks sometimes. I'm trying to repair my reputation here.
Love with that. Okay, so becoming a storyteller. So this theme came about because I did a little story event yesterday at my home for members of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Hagerstown, who each paid big bucks at the church auction back in the spring for the privilege of coming to my house and being fed. I did give them dinner or a big lunch, so perhaps that was perhaps they thought they got their money's worth. But the topic, or the published topic, was discovering great-grandfather, because I was going to talk about, because I was asked to tell about how I became a storyteller. And my great-grandfather, T.H. Barnes, growing up with that story was really the impetus that got me started on storytelling in general. I was already trying to write a few stories to share with my extended family, especially with my brother's kids. And I had played around with stories a little bit before that, trying to remember all of the stories that I had wooed my mother with, trying to get her to laugh, or baiting her by telling my own versions of events that I knew she had experienced herself and would have a very different telling of if she were going to share some of those experiences. But it was telling stories about my great-grandfather, Thomas Henry Barnes, that really got me thinking about becoming a professional storyteller, and got me thinking about what stories need to be told out in the world, not just my family experiences. So when I was preparing for the event yesterday, where I was going to have these eight people that I know very well, there was nobody there that was a stranger to me, and most people I've known for more than a decade, I was trying to think about what they would expect, what they would want to experience as part of the day. And I kind of strayed a bit from the original theme and started thinking about all of my experiences that led me to want to tell stories. So by the time we got to the event yesterday, my plan was that I would bring out a whole stack of books. So I probably brought out 50 or more books. There were at least 50 books on the table, each of which had led me to tell a story. And I invited them to pick a book and ask me questions about that story. But then I also had this brilliant idea to bring out all of these little business cards. I have probably, 500 business cards in my file. And each one of those people, those businesses, those organizations have somehow piqued my interest. So I pulled out about 50 of those cards and wrote questions on the back of, or wrote notes on the back of, about what had sparked a story in me from those individuals. And I offered them, the participants yesterday, a choice of choosing a card or choosing a book or doing both. And that's how we did the session. So it was very loose. We spent about an hour and a half on food. That's a 3-hour session. But we spent another hour and a half on storytelling, and some of them told stories in the process, and I answered a lot of questions and gave kind of little thumbnail sketches of the stories that were represented by those business cards and books. And I had a wonderful time. It was definitely not my usual format for storytelling, but based on that, I thought I would use that theme. I would suggest that theme to you, becoming a storyteller, as one that we could talk about today. So I will give a little thumbnail sketch of the discovering great-grandfather part, but then in the process, I will probably mention other stories that came in between some of my development of T.H. Barnes' story, based on what I learned about him as a child and the autobiography that he left to the family. So I can very vividly remember being 3 years old and then 4 and 5 years old, and my dad telling me stories about my great-grandfather, my father's grandfather. And the first time we were sitting on my bed in my bedroom, and he pulled out the manuscript, this handwritten manuscript that T.H. Barnes had left to the family that my father had custody of. And he read to me some of it, and he talked about the quilt that we were sitting on my bed, and how my grandmother and my great-grandmother and my great-great-grandmother all had quilts like this. And he went on to tell me a little bit about T.H. Barnes' father's escape out of slavery in the early 1800s. And then read me bits and pieces of the manuscript. So that was a really memorable occasion. And he read to me as bedtime stories from the manuscript over the next decade, probably. And I was also hearing him tell stories that his grandfather had told him in person, not just limited to what was in the typed version. So I grew up with those stories. My dad talked about his grandfather and his great-grandfather all the time. And it was clearly important to him and became really important to me as part of who I was. At some point, I realized that not everybody in our extended family knew these stories. When we would go to visit the relatives every summer in upstate New York, and I would mention something about great-grandfather T.H. Barnes, Thomas Henry Barnes, it wasn't even clear that everybody knew who I was talking about. So these were my cousins and my aunts and my uncles. And while the elders certainly knew who he was, they didn't necessarily have many stories about him. And so those stories became even more important to me when I realized that these stories were not universal, even within my father's close relatives, that part of the family. And because we were going up there regularly, and after a while there was an official family reunion, the Barnes Crawford Easley family reunion that I was going to almost every year as a young adult, I started thinking about, well, since I know these stories, I have a responsibility to share them. There are other people who would love to know these stories. There are other people who need to know these stories. And how can I do that? And I was way too intimidated to think about telling these stories to the grownups at the reunion. So I started thinking, well, how would I share with the children? And I did come up with a very short story about Henry Barnes, my great-great-grandfather, being taken from a farm outside Richmond, Virginia, and taken to Hagerstown by his new owner, his new master, Reverend Barnes, as he is called in all of those stories. And that went okay. It was, the stories were well received by the older children. There were 2 and 3 year olds in my audience. There were probably 6 or 8 children in the little circle that I gathered to tell some stories. And the older children were very interested and asked a lot of questions. The younger ones, of course, I had to add all kinds of early childhood tricks, like having us ride in the wagon that Henry would have been in as he traveled as a child from Richmond, Virginia to Hagerstown, Maryland. And I talked about the rivers and the waterways that they would have crossed on their way to Hagerstown. But it went okay. So eventually, a few years later, I ended up telling a 3-minute version of T.H. Barnes' story about his father. And that went over pretty well. I was limited with time because the only time to really talk to the group as a whole was at the big dinner. And we have a picnic that lasts half a day. It starts at noon every year and runs till about five. And then we all go take naps and showers. And then we go back to a big hall or a big restaurant to have dinner. And we're talking about up to 100 people. There can be 150 people at the picnics, or there used to be. There are not quite so many now. But at the restaurants or the halls where we have the dinner, there's usually at least 50 to 75. A lot of them are children. And the ones who are grown-ups have probably been tippling since morning, or at least since the afternoon. They have had a nap, many of them, but I knew I didn't have more than 3 minutes to tell a story at the dinner. But that went over well as well that first year. And I've told stories about T.H. Barnes a couple times since then. After my father died, we had a big memorial service for him at the Ethical Society in Philadelphia. Philadelphia was where my parents were. That's where I grew up. And a lot of relatives came to that event, and a lot of other people that my parents had known in Philadelphia that my mother invited. And among those people was a woman who worked at Temple University with my mother. And she was a member of the African American Family Reunion Association. In fact, she was at least a board member, and she may have been one of the founders. But she was very interested in some of the stories that I told at my dad's service. She wanted lots more information about our family. She had met my dad, but she didn't know him very well. She knew my mother pretty well from working with her, but she didn't really know my dad very well. So she had lots of questions, and we had about a 10-minute conversation, which was possibly the longest conversation I had with anyone at the memorial service, because there were, more than 100 people there. And I had a lot of people to talk to, including family members. But in that conversation with this woman who was at that time in the leadership of the African American Family Reunion Association, she invited me to come and speak at the next conference, the next association conference. And I ended up doing that. And that was an amazing experience to me, because all of these people were interested in family stories, and they were all interested in African-American family stories, and about a third of them were white people. So there were just so many connections, so many ways to explore those interests, and so many different points of view, and crafting the story so that it would appeal to people who were coming from the family reunion aspect was interesting and exciting to me. And that kind of got me started on the process of thinking about how to tell these stories outside my own family. So I'm going to stop there, Stosh. there's so much more to say, but that's kind of the beginning of me thinking about telling my grandfather's story, my great-grandfather's story, and my great-great-grandfather's story, and my dad's story, and all of our connections. And of course, my mother's side of the family as well. That was kind of a launching pad for me thinking more broadly about what this story means to me.
And I have always enjoyed all of your stories about, well, I always enjoy your stories, but especially your stories about T.H. And the first time I heard you tell as TH, I was amazed. I was able to close my eyes, and then you disappeared, and this old African-American man was there, and you do such a great job about that. I don't ever, in my storytelling, I never try to do voices, because every time I try to do voices, I wind up trying to be comic, a comic, and it doesn't work. You know, I've done a lot of stage work, and in all the stage work I've ever done, I've used my own voice, except I've used an accent when I needed to use an accent. But that always took weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks, even months of work. And even then, I've never been real confident in my own mind. I've never had a director say that was the worst accent I've ever heard in my life. But I do remember. I did a show once, and I worked really hard, really hard, really hard. It was called Dr. Cook's Garden, and I was supposed to be a guy from Vermont, New England, someplace. Anyway, I worked really, really hard to try to get an accent, and the first time the director said, "Just take your time. We have 2 months before we actually have to do the show. So, find something comfortable. Don't worry about it. Just learn your lines first, and then we'll work on the accent." And finally, I said to him, I'm going to try the accent. And we only did about 15 minutes of the opening scene. And we had a break, and he said, I'm not sure being South Korean or North Korean or whatever the Korean you're doing is from Vermont. and I was appalled because I had worked so hard. But then he had made a recording, and he played it back to me, and I said, "Oh my God, that doesn't sound like anything like it is in my head." So he suggested that I use a tape recorder and work on it more and more. And eventually I did. I actually was able to find someone who was going to Vermont, an ex-student of mine, who I was doing some storytelling with at the time, and ask her to record somebody. She said she would be going, doing a lot of shopping and everything. I said, "If you run into any older guys, and get me some recordings of voices of typical sounds." And she did. She actually sat next to a guy and kind of encouraged him to tell her a story. And he was glad to do it. And so I had about a 15-minute tape that I could listen to it. And it gave me some interesting things. So I got away with it. By the time the show actually, was put up, and it was a dinner theater, so I had to do it 8 times. But by the end of the run, I think I did a pretty good job. But it was.
You still have that tape?
No.
Oh boy, play that on the radio.
Boy, I wish I did, but I'm telling you. A lot of the things I use in the beginning about storytelling and theater, I wish I did keep all that stuff, but I got a lot of stuff like that where I would purposely record some rehearsals so that I could practice my lines against the other people, and stuff. But like so many things, I have all kind of stuff that I've collected over the years. And every once in a while, I've looked in boxes and said, "Oh wow, look at this!" And that's the other thing. I like what one of the things that you mentioned that struck me as, wouldn't it be daring and creative to have a storytelling thing at Stories and Around, and but and somehow have the audience, you know, hand you something in say in wrapped in a handkerchief or something like that, and say, tell us a story. That'd be a challenge. I think that would be a great challenge thing for four or five storytellers sitting up front.
A challenge telling.
Yeah, that would be. Wouldn't that be something? You know.
Yeah, that would be fun.
And the reason I thought that when you were talking about it was because I have this habit myself. I have lots of things. You know, I'm old, so I've collected lots of things, and I can go to my closet and pick up something, and I can stand there and right away I can tell myself a story. You know, there's something laying there, you know, and I guess this is true of lots of older people. And especially it would be older people who are teachers or who did storytelling or even not, but older people have stories about things that they have, you right. know? I thought, man, that would be fun. That might be fun even for like a workshop thing.
Yeah, that'd be great.
To have all the storytellers bring something and mm-hmm. say, okay, I have something in my hand. Who wants it? And who's going to tell a story about it? You know, I would be creative. I think it'd be fun to do as a house concert kind of for storytellers. You know, and so because, I just thought that would be fun because that's something I could do. I often had stuff on my desk in as a teacher. Once I started telling stories in the classroom, if I had something interesting that I came across, I might take it, put it in my pocket, put it on my desk in school, and just wait. And sometimes that might be there for a week or so, or even more. And then finally, somebody would say, what is that thing? You know, and I would say, and then I would tell a story about it, and often there would be something related to science. Mm-hmm. You know, might be an instrument of some kind or other, or just something that would have a scientific story around it. Mm-hmm. And I like doing that because making lesson plans to teach chemistry, and I taught a lot of science topics, but mostly chemistry and also math. After a while, it became boring to me. And I, you know, because as a student, I always liked the classes. My favorite teachers were those who either told stories or else made up bizarre stuff and picked on the kids. I always like the teachers who would, as long as they didn't pick on me, you know, who would be giving somebody a hard time in class, because it broke up the class. And I realized as a young teacher, kids can like you very much, but if you are giving them a dull story, a dull talk about anything, if you're yeah. dull, you can tell by their eyebrows.
Yes.
You can tell by the nods in their head. You can tell. I said this once, and I got chastised for saying this once in the faculty meeting, that I'm amazed the number of times the guys will sit and stare at you and be bored to death, but girls will do things.
Yes.
They'll fiddle with their blouse, or they'll fiddle with their skirt, or they'll fiddle with. And one of the women on the faculty said to me, I was a young teacher at the time when I said this in the meeting. This one woman, older woman, said, "Mr. Z, I think you're paying too much attention to the girls."
Right. Well, Mr. Z, let me ask, are you ready to tell an official story right now?
About becoming a storyteller?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. I will.
But why don't you do a station identification?
Okay. You're listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour, broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia, Martinsburg, West Virginia, in Hagerstown, Maryland. This is with Stacy Okowski and
Betty Crawford.
Right. And you can also check in that we have lots of podcasts of our stories. In fact, over 300 of them, which I found to be amazing. I just checked recently on how many. And it's, can you believe we could talk that much? Anyway, at talltales.enlightenradio.org. And you can look at that up and find the most recent stories and all the way back to 2017, which is amazing. Anyway, as a young teacher, I know I probably have said this before, but as a young teacher, I realized that one of the very first lectures I gave, I told a story about scientists, about an element that was discovered. And the first time I mentioned this, I think, in storytelling, I said, and I noticed that my students were awake. And there were young people in the audience that laughed. And I said, aha, you must have been in one of my classes. And it reminded me that in teaching, it really helped if you could say something interesting to the kids, or if you could make them, especially if you could make them laugh. But so I started telling short stories about chemists, scientists, mathematicians, people who won Nobel Prizes, and I would try to, in any of my lectures about chemistry or my classes, I would try to include a little story, a tidbit that might be interesting, something, try to find something interesting about the person's life. And then that would stimulate questions, which made it much easier especially for someone who knows the subject, to answer questions about the science, instead of having to always be the one giving out the information. Unfortunately, as a young teacher, once I got into public school, in the first 3 years of teaching, I was in a private school. Brother Kevin was my mentor. Brother John was my, Brother Larry is my second mentor. Brother John was my third mentor. And those three men offered me advice and, you know, some mentoring about my teaching. But they did it in a positive way. When I got to the public school, I found out that the people who came in to evaluate you as a teacher, vice principals, department chairman, supervisors of science or math, seemed, this is probably wrong, and if they were all sitting in front of me now, they would be willing to say, you're wrong, and tell me all kind of things about why. But it seemed to me that they were there to criticize. They weren't there to guide or mentor so much in a positive way as to tell you all the things you did wrong during, you know, your presentation. And at first, as a teacher in the public school, I was
relying on my
students' response to whatever I did in class. And if my students were passing my tests, and my students seemed happy and weren't sleeping during class and weren't asking to go to the laboratory 60 times or something, which never really happened because I let kids go out of class, go to the laboratory without even, they didn't have to ask permission, just raise their hand and point to the door. And so telling stories, I found, made class more palatable to the students and a lot easier on me. In fact, I found that I would think this is my way of looking at it. On my good days, class was over before I got finished with my lesson. And that was one of the comments I heard from my from a man named John, who was my science department chairman over years, who said, "You, I can't believe that you ever get anything done in your class." And I said, "Just check the records. My kids passed, do really well on the year-end exams." Because in the, both of the counties that I mainly taught in, both counties had year-end exams in chemistry. And that seemed to be it was one of those things where the people in charge, they loved to be able to talk to you about your year-end exam results. And I can remember over the years meeting young teachers or new teachers to the system who were just so upset because their kids did not get as good a grade on the year-end exams as the boss thought they
Folks,
should have.
I have to
and they worried about that so much.
I have to interrupt for a second. Comcast.
I saw your chat.
Comcast is working in the area, and we're going to lose connectivity. Right now, I'm getting warnings, I already had about a 3-second interruption. So I would encourage you to sort of bring the show to a close, and then it'll be easy to at least edit it. Okay. There haven't been any error. There's that one error about a minute ago, so that shouldn't be too bad to fix. But we should. I can tell they're in the area and probably going to lose internet altogether. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thanks.
All right, so
Stosh, we're going to need to break here and close out our show. We're having technical issues.
All right.
But that was a great story.
Okay.
You've been listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org, broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia, Martinsburg, West Virginia, and Hagerstown, Maryland. Stay tuned for John Case and country music.